You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. From praising dictators to alienating allies, President Donald Trump has made chaos his calling card. Has his strategy caused more problems than it solved? CNN's chief national security correspondent and anchor of CNN Newsroom, Jim Sciutto, tries to answer that question in a new book titled The Madman Theory: Trump Takes on the World. And today, Jim Sciutto joins me on the podcast to discuss the Nixon-era origins of the so-called madman theory and how it applies to Trump's scattershot approach to national security. He talks about Trump's disdain for his own national security team in favor of a shadow cabinet of informal advisors that wields enormous influence over this president. He also reveals that the president's intelligence team deliberately avoids bringing up Russia for fear of setting him off, and how this has led to a dangerous ignorance of America's number one geopolitical foe. He gets into the president's fraught relationship with China, how Trump went from fire and fury to falling in love with Kim Jong-un, and what the failed Hanoi summit taught him about the limits of personal diplomacy. Plus, how the Pentagon dangled oil money to keep the president from withdrawing out of Syria. One source who makes the cryptic claim that Vladimir Putin is Donald Trump's honeypot, and what Trump's golf game can teach us about his approach to foreign policy. Coming up with CNN's Jim Sciutto in just a moment. Jim Sciutto is CNN's chief national security correspondent and anchor of CNN Newsroom. After more than two decades as a foreign correspondent stationed in Asia, Europe, and the Middle East, he returned to Washington to cover the Defense Department, the State Department, and intelligence agencies for CNN. His work has earned him Emmy Awards, the George Polk Award, the Edward R. Murrow Award, and the Merriman Smith Memorial Award for Excellence in Presidential Coverage. He's also a best-selling author, and now he's out with his latest book titled The Madman Theory: Trump Takes on the World. Jim Sciutto, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. I've really been looking forward to this.
Well, the title of your book, The Madman Theory, is a reference to a national security strategy that sort of crystallized during the Nixon administration, although some would say that it really goes back as far as the Eisenhower era. Before we even get to Donald Trump, explain the madman theory and how Nixon applied it during the Vietnam War.
So Nixon applied it deliberately, and as you say, inspired a bit by his perception of Eisenhower during the Korean War. But the way it transpired under Nixon was during really tense part of the negotiations with North Vietnam during the war in the early 70s. Nixon instructed his national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, to convey to the North Vietnamese that Nixon was just crazy enough to launch a nuclear attack on North Vietnam, to push them into a friendlier position in the negotiations. And they're actually, this conversation was caught on tape, you know, the Nixon tapes, and I read the transcripts of them. He even practically gives Kissinger the words to use to the North Vietnamese, rather, when conveying this. Now, as it play out, Kissinger did convey that to the North Vietnamese. It didn't work, though. They didn't soften their position in the negotiations. And of course, you know how the Vietnam worked out for Nixon and the U.S. That said, Nixon and his team, they owned it afterwards. H.R. Haldeman writes in his memoirs, you know, and even dubbed it the madman theory as an approach that they saw as a good way to set your adversaries off balance in the midst of either negotiations or at times of war. Now, the thing about Trump is that this idea in speaking to his advisors, both critics or loyalists, that he deliberately is unpredictable, right? And this is something you've heard talked about. And the president has even said, he's like, in a negotiation, you know, keep him off balance and, you know, kind of surprise him at the finish. And that could be the thing that turns it around in your favor. The trouble with Trump's version of the madman theory is one that by all accounts, folks I spoke with, it's not so much a plan as an accident of his style of leadership. Right, that he is unpredictable, but often in spite of himself. Right, and then the second aspect of it, which is somewhat disturbing, right, is that he has used this approach not just with U.S. adversaries, but with U.S. allies and even members of his own administration, unpredictable to them, to the point where they would communicate to friends and enemies, we don't know what he's going to do next. Right. And then we've seen that play out on a whole host of issues in this presidency, some of which I lay out in the book.
Well, yeah, Nixon applied this to a very specific situation with a clear adversary during the war. But for Trump, it seems to be the option of first resort. And I wonder if you think that reinforces the threat that he really is this wild card who might do anything. Or does that strategy, to the extent that it is any kind of a strategy, does it lose its teeth? I mean, what good is a bluff if everyone knows that you're bluffing all the time?
Yeah, one thing I try to do in the book is lay out before and after of Trump on all these key national security threats, China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, et cetera, and just say, okay, you know, if you think this is a viable strategy, let's look at where it got us after 4 years. And in each of those places, you don't see it gaining the U.S. measurably position. Often in some, you see it putting us in a worse stead. I mean, I use the example of North Korea, right? I mean, this was a classic, you know, application of that madman theory. And the Trump administration started with fire and fury, right? Little rocket man, you know, he's on a suicide mission, you know, discussions of a military strike on North Korea, you know, at the height of this, and then a sudden switch to, actually, you know what, let's sit down at the table. And by the way, President Trump, can, based purely on my relationship with Kim Jong-un, move this mountain, right, in nuclear negotiations. And Trump often, I mean, I remember, I covered all three summits. You know, sometimes these summits came largely out of the blue. The third one at the DMZ, you know, that was on again, off again, and suddenly invited by tweet, right? You know, hours before it took place, catching, you know, a lot of his staff, his own staff off guard. So if you look at that, you know, at times throughout, you could say, well, maybe this upset could surprise North Korea into negotiating. But at the end of the day, here we are 4 years later, and they've got more, not fewer nukes, right? They have a broader nuclear and missile program, not a thinner one. So when you apply it to the real world, in many of these instances, it failed, frankly.
North Korea is the only country that you break into two chapters in your book, Fire and Fury and then Falling in Love. Mm-hmm. I wonder, do Trump's aides and supporters believe that the escalation of rhetoric during that Fire and Fury period is what eventually brought Kim to the negotiating table? And are they right?
There's a disagreement. And just for the sake of your listeners, this book is based entirely on folks who served in the Trump administration at the most senior level, Trump administration officials, some of whom, you know, you might see as critics of this administration, Fiona Hill, H.R. McMaster, but others who were true loyalists, Peter Navarro, Steve Bannon, you know, that kind of thing. So I'm talking to folks, and you often get a disparate view of how it played out. So with North Korea, for instance, there is a point of view in his administration that without fire and fury, you would not have gotten to the negotiating table, that Trump effectively scared Kim Jong-un into sitting down and talking. Now, there's another view, and I speak to Joseph Yun, for instance, who was Trump's lead North Korea negotiator for more than a year. And some of this lines up, frankly, with the U.S. intel assessment of North Korea, is that Kim moved at the end of 2017, early 2018, because he reached a conclusion that he had the nuclear program he wanted, that he felt strong enough, he'd advanced strong enough. You'll probably remember that, you know, it was late in 2017 that North Korea set off its biggest nuclear test by far, 6 nuclear tests, which the U.S. believed was a thermonuclear device. So that, you know, with that progress, Kim could say, all right, I got the cards in this right now. I could sit down and talk. And the worry among Trump's advisors throughout was, okay, wait, is he going to play us? Is he going to stretch this out like Kim and his father and grandfather before him did to previous presidents? Or are we going to get somewhere? And, you know, you look where we are today and you might say, you know, we got played once again.
Yeah, one of the centerpieces of Trump's foreign policy has been his reliance on personal relationships with world leaders. Mm. And I remember in that second summit in Hanoi, he couldn't get any major concessions from Kim and he had to walk away. Among the people with whom you spoke, did any of them say that maybe Trump learned something from that about the limits of his brand of personal diplomacy?
It's a great point, and it's one I highlight in the book, that Trump does, and even his biggest critics will acknowledge this, he does at times self-correct. And that was a great example of it, where going in to the second summit, and again, I was there in Hanoi, his advisors were saying, wait a second, you know, none of the groundwork is laid here. We're worried this is going to be another show, just like Singapore had been before it. Mike Pompeo, I recount this in the book, went out early and tried to sit down with the lead North Korean negotiator before just to say, hey, show us some cards here so we know what's going to happen so we don't get embarrassed again. And the guy wouldn't even meet him, you know. So there were signs going in. And when Trump saw what they were willing to offer, he, you know, he called it the walk. You know, he said, no, not good enough. And that was an example where, and I speak to Sue Gordon, for instance, who was the second senior most U.S. intelligence official at the time, who often briefed the president. She said that was a time where I felt like we reached him. You know, we reached him and convinced him that it wasn't working. Now, lo and behold, he went back for another face-to-face summit, you know, imagining that the sort of charm offensive from Trump himself would change the dynamic, and it just didn't do it.
Mm-hmm. Fiona Hill refers to something that she calls the hyper-personalization of the U.S. Mm. presidency in your book. What does she mean by that?
It's a real, you know, she's such a sharp observer of President Trump, and I know she testified, as you know, in the impeachment hearing, and folks might imagine that she is a you know, she's a Trump hater or never Trumper. She's not. I mean, we have many conversations for this book, and she spoke of efforts that the president made with Russia, even, for instance, that she felt had some substance to them, right? So, but her view of the way he operates is that, and this is certainly not confined to her, right? This is a consistent thing, is that everything runs through the prism of Trump. That everything, in his view, is reflected, one, how does it affect his interests, right? You see this. How does it affect his political fortunes? You know, a whole host of things are run through that filter for him. You know, withdrawing troops from Afghanistan or Syria. I made a promise to end the endless wars. Even if generals on the ground are saying, if we pull out now, we're going to lose against ISIS. He's like, yeah, but I got this campaign promise, right? You know, it's run through that single filter. I mean, she talked about it even as it related to the coronavirus pandemic, as that was beginning to break out, where for him, he saw it as, wait a second, my number one campaign sales pitch is being undermined by this pandemic. How could this be happening to me? Which prevented, one, a comprehensive response at the start of it. And we're paying the price of that right now. But two, also even kind of an expression of empathy, right, for the people going through it. And Fiona Hill made a very interesting comparison for it. You know, someone who, of course, is a student of Russia, she said, to a degree, hyper-personalization to a degree, not even present under Putin in Russia, in that she found that all decisions, everything just through Trump. There was no structure under it. There's no decision by committee. And she said, even under Putin, later in his term, there were attempts to kind of spread, and granted, listen, Putin's authoritarian. I'm not defending him. I'm just saying in the decision-making in the Kremlin, she said there were attempts to spread the decision-making around, whereas in Trump's world, it's gone the opposite direction, shrunk just to him, to the point, she says this in the book as well, where when she would meet with counterparts in Europe, friends and or Russian counterparts, they would say, well, how do we know what you're telling me means anything, because Trump could just change his mind the next day? She's like, I didn't really have an answer to that.
Yeah, and that's a dangerous situation, because that's where 99% of the real work gets done, not directly in conversations with Donald Trump.
Yeah, it's true. Sue Gordon made that point. You know, she asked me, she said, what percentage of decisions in government do you think, national security decisions, do you think the president makes? And I was like, I don't know, half, you know, two-thirds, you know, you just kind of imagine. She's like 99.9% are decisions made outside, you know, not in defiance of the commander-in-chief, but just that there's stuff coming at you every day. So, and she made that point in the context of another thing that's a phenomenon of the Trump presidency, is the complete dissolution of a national security process. Mm-hmm. You know, I tell a couple stories of where, you know, the national security process would happen after the decision, not before it.
Yeah.
Right? Like the two withdrawals from Syria by tweet, surprising his own staff, you know, they came up with the sort of explanation for it afterwards, not before, because there was no debate before. There were no situation room meetings that discussed the second and third and fourth order consequences of it. Trump, as you know, he's attacked institutions, individuals, and even the process. And another instance of just the hyper-personalization of this.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. Trump's policy on Syria has been schizophrenic at best. How did his military advisors manage to talk him out of a total withdrawal from Syria? Twice.
Well, it's really interesting. It's twice. It's I talk about this in details, you know, in the book. So the first one came, both of these come after conversations. This is another phenomenon of Trump, right? He has a phone conversation with a foreign leader who he likes and changes his mind on the phone. And that happened with both, you know, he's talking to Erdogan, Turkish president leader, and going into the meeting, there's no discussion of withdrawal. He has a conversation, comes out, and he says, we're out of Syria. Now, what happens in the wake of that, in the wake of both instances of this, is his Pentagon advisors say, wait a second, where did this come from? Are you kidding me? We got to leave now in the midst of, you know, we got, you know, first one came as they feel like they're surrounding Baghdadi, you know, the leader of ISIS. We can't do that. We can't abandon our Kurdish allies. They're at the tip of the spear here, et cetera. And then they try to figure out how they can satisfy him just enough before his attention is diverted elsewhere. And in the first instance, after the first withdrawal, they figure out a way, okay, let's withdraw a few hundred troops. We can still maintain our footprint, still give the support to the Kurds we need, still keep our eyes on ISIS, but give him something and hope that he stops paying attention. And that worked. 10 months later, he withdraws again by tweet. And then they're thinking, all right, we're really screwed this time. Is there any way we can keep a footprint on the ground? They try again. They're like, okay, let's take a couple hundred out. Let's keep these guys in. But wait a second, here's an idea for how to change his view of this. Let's now recast the role of US forces there, not as even fighting ISIS or holding back Russia and Iran, but as protecting the oil fields. They present that to him, and he says, oh, pretend, that sounds like that's in our interest to protect the oil fields. And lo and behold, it works. And we still have forces on the ground in Syria, smaller footprint than they would like, but it's something. And it's a way, I don't know, quite fooling the president, but convincing him that he's getting what he wants while still maintaining, you know, some presence there to support what is the U.S. national security goal there.
Right, because as he's expressed several times, whenever we get involved militarily in a country, he sees that as an opportunity for us to somehow profit and get a hold of their oil, right, in the end game.
Illegal, but heck, yeah. You know, here we are.
Well, oftentimes military advisors and national security advisors to a president will offer him a range of options for dealing with a particular crisis with a few crazy ideas thrown in just to make the proposals that they are really advocating for look reasonable. But Joseph Yun, who you mentioned a moment ago, Trump's special envoy for North Korea, said you have to be careful which options you give Trump, because with Trump, he just might go for the craziest one, huh?
Yeah, recount a couple of incidents in the book where the Pentagon actually hesitated to give him military options because they were afraid he might use them and end up unwittingly in a war. And one was in, as Joseph Yun recounts, during one of the tensest times with North Korea, late 2017. If you remember this phrase, the bloody nose strike, you know, right. This idea that you could have some sort of limited military action that would send a message. The thing is, no one I spoke to in the Pentagon believes such a thing exists, because from North Korea's perspective, any small strike was, they would see as precursor to a decapitation strike. So they would react with all they had, you know, rain hellfire down on Seoul, for instance, which they have the ability to do. So in the midst of that, Joseph Yun describes where there was time when the White House was looking for the whole range of military options, and the Pentagon and other diplomats, U.S. diplomats involved, said, let's hold back, because they were worried he might use them. And Yun describes the reaction from the White House, of quoting from him. He said, the White House is like, God damn it, we want military options. But, you know, it was a case where they were so concerned that a capricious president, an unpredictable president, a madman president might actually do it. And lo and behold, we'd be in a war. And you know, listen, the estimates of a quote unquote limited military engagement with North Korea, you know, has a death toll in the tens of thousands. So, you know, that's the level of concern that the national security complex had with President Trump, that they didn't want to give him the option to get into that kind of situation.
And when the president's intelligence briefer and other advisors try to get his attention on a particular issue, how do they usually go about that?
It's hard to get him to read. You know, and it's this is a thing I describe in the book. And to my knowledge, no one else has described this before, but that under H.R. McMaster, when he was the national security advisor, he and his team found that the president was not reading his briefing materials. And they could tell that because they would go in, they would have given him briefing materials on X threat, right? North Korea, Iran, you name it. They'd go in and then they'd bring up stuff that was in the materials, and it was the first time the president clearly was hearing it. So McMaster came up with an idea of boiling those briefings down to a single index cards with three bullet points, a couple sentence each, figuring he would read this. So they try that, and it works for a little bit. They get the sense he's processing more of that information. Then they start to discover, based on their questions and their interactions, that he's only reading the first two of the three bullet points. He's not even getting to the number three. So they start concentrating the information just in the first two, and the third one becomes a throwaway line. And then over time, they realize he's not even reading that. So it's hard to get his attention with things. One thing that does work, and I've heard this from people who've briefed him, is that he likes to know the economic aspect of any national security issue. How is trade involved in this? Think oil in Syria, right? You know, how do you get his attention by saying protecting the oil fields in Syria? So you know, economics, and you could see that in his public statements and his decision making, even say with the way he deals with NATO allies, right? You know, budget issues over the actual national security threat.
And now, you spoke with Steve Bannon for this book, and he drew an interesting analogy between Trump's approach to policy and Trump's golf game. Can you explain that?
He said, when you play golf with Trump, which I haven't done, he said he does not hit balls on the range before. He just goes out and swings. He's a game day player, self-described. And he said that's the way he approaches the most consequential decisions of government. That he trusts his gut so much that he goes in, wings it, and feels like he's going to come out ahead. Now, that is often in defiance of the record, right? Because you could say the game day golfer, that's exactly how he played North Korea in three face-to-face meetings, didn't get him or us anywhere, right? But this is a very confident leader. That's another description I got from others, you know, than Bannon. Sue Gordon briefed him many times, said he's a confident decision maker, you know, more confident than she's seen in government. And she said, though, confident to the point where not even does he just ignore others' advice if he thinks his own view of things is better or smarter, but he often ignores or questions facts and information, you know, intelligence. They'll come and say, we know X to be true, and say, I don't believe that. Wow. And that's a real difficult space to go, because she said there are times where we think stuff and there's times where we know stuff. Mm-hmm. And when he disagrees when we know stuff, that's a problem.
Yeah. With the exit of McMaster and Kelly, Mattis, Bolton, and a whole list of bodies that have been left in his wake, are there any serious policymakers left in the White House to temper his madman impulses now?
Short answer is no, or few. Wow. If there are, it's a tightening circle over time. And the president has, you know, he clearly doesn't want folks to challenge him, because you see how they end up, right? The folks who offer the contrary advice are either forced out, resign, or publicly shamed, you know, over time. And it's difficult to see who in this White House is the one who is willing to walk up to him and say, this ain't going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe, and he's not in the White House, maybe McConnell at times. I mean, you saw that recently, for instance, on delaying the election, where, you know, McConnell said, no, that's just not going to happen. But inside the White House, and sadly, more and more in other institutions outside the White House. But I mean, when you put a political, flunky, almost frankly, as the senior most intelligence official in the country, Rick Grenell followed by John Ratcliffe, you're not, the chances of getting the contrary advice decrease significantly. Yeah.
Now, I've heard former Trump officials like Bolton say that they were often thwarted by a shadow cabinet of sorts, these informal advisors outside of the government who seem to have Trump's ear on a whole range of issues. Who are these people?
Well, some of them, you know, right? Okay. I mean, Tucker Carlson, businessman from New York. I recount an incident in the book, where Tucker Carlson spoke with the president around the time that he pulled back retaliation against Iran for shooting down that drone over international waters in the Persian Gulf. You'll remember in 2019, the planes were in the air and the president pulled it back. Now, the public story, and I tell this in the book, is the president found out that it was possible that as many as 150 Iranians could be killed in the U.S. retaliatory military action, and he made a decision that was too much. Now, that's a fair decision to make after the shootdown of an unmanned drone, but that is information, as I tell in the book, that would have been at the front end of discussion of that military option. He wouldn't have found that out after planes were already in the air. And the New York Times, by the way, reported this as well earlier. Around the same time, the president was speaking to Tucker Carlson, who said, you know, you get us into another war there, you're going to lose the election. And again, so here's a non-official advisor delivering consequential advice, but also in the category of, something that relates to the election. It wasn't a judgment of the national security implications of it, or what we're going to get, or is it going to bring us closer to goals? Well, wait a second. I'm going to be damaged in the election. We can't do that. And there are numerous instances of where he speaks to folks outside and his formal advisors, and frankly, listens to them. Mm-hmm. It's something Master and others describe it as the people in his ear. They were often worried about the people in his ear.
Now, I was amazed to read that intelligence agencies briefed Trump less and less, specifically on Russia, because he would blow up whenever Russia came up in briefings. Yeah. Shouldn't we be alarmed that the president of the United States is being left in the dark about one of, if not the biggest adversary that America has?
Yes, it's shocking that on the one end that the president doesn't want to hear it. And that's something that I suppose we should understand and accept by now, because it is so ingrained in this president's approach to foreign policy. Because as I note in the book, one of the most, arguably the most consistent feature of Trump's foreign policy is deference to Russia on a whole host of issues. But that the intelligence community would feel the need to react to that and tell him less about it is alarming too. Now, the way it was explained to me is this, is that you have a relationship with the president as the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, CIA, et cetera. You have limited engagements with the president, and you have to keep that line of communication open. And what they found is that if we brought up Russia every day or every other day, or when it wasn't life or death, it just blinded, you know, the blinders went off, right? You know, the fingers went in the ear practically, and then they lost that line of communication. So they made a judgment to say, okay, we're only going to bring it up when he's got to know it today, you know, and lives are at stake, and not other times. Now, that's it's a tough judgment call to be in, considering, as you say, Russia is, if not the one of the two greatest national security threats to the U.S., along with China. And I spoke to a former senior member of the National Security Staff in the White House who said to me, the byproduct of that decision was that over time, the president became less aware of the Russia threat. So that sometimes when he said he wasn't aware of the severity of the Russia threat or certain aspects of it, he was telling the truth, but because he hadn't been told.
Well, specifically with regard to the intelligence that Russia had offered bounties for killing U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan, do you think that information made its way to the president, or is it possible that that's another example of him not being interested in something or just not wanting to hear about it?
Well, it's CNN's reporting that it was certainly in his briefing. Right. And his written briefing. Now, to get into the written briefing, as I just described to you, doesn't guarantee it gets into the president's brain. Right. Because he doesn't read this stuff.
Right.
And that's multiple accounts. Whether it was highlighted to him in a conversation, we don't know for sure. What's remarkable, though, is this, that even when it was out in the public sphere, then the president knows now. Right. I mean, he's read in the papers. The president's reaction is to question it, call it another Russia hoax. You've heard that phrase from him, and not once raise it in one of the half a dozen phone calls he's had with Putin. You know, he can argue, and even others who take it seriously can say, well, it's not 100% confirmed. But what he never did was say, guys, this is true. I won't stand for it. He's never said that to Putin. By the way, the pattern extends further back because we know, and this is harder intelligence, that in 2018, Russia was arming the Taliban. And the way the president responded to that, I'm sure you've seen these comments recently, he said, well, we armed the Taliban, you know, back in the 80s. You know, this kind of whataboutism, which frankly mimics Kremlin talking points on that kind of stuff. So it's, you know, even when he finds out about it, his reaction and decision making is it's truly remarkable for a U.S. president.
And this brings to mind one of the great mysteries of this presidency, which is Trump's one-sided bromance with Vladimir Putin and his utter capitulation to Putin on a variety of issues from Ukraine to Syria, the hacking of the election. Is that relationship equally an enigma to the people who work for Donald Trump?
Yeah. Yes. And I asked everybody I interviewed, loyalist or doubter or critic or people in between, explain to me the president's fascination with Vladimir Putin. Mm-hmm. Explain to me. And the one that they came that was the most unanimous was that he has an odd admiration for Vladimir Putin. He envies his power. He shares his somewhat nihilistic view of relationships among countries that, you know, it's really the end of American exceptionalism in Trump's view, his idea that we're all power players. None of us, you know, we're not particularly good. You remember Trump's comments to Bill O'Reilly very early in his term, you know, O'Reilly says Putin's a killer. He says, well, are we that great? You know, that Trump shares Putin's view even of our country, right? Mm-hmm. Let alone Russia and the world, envies his power. But, and this is the more, even more worrisome part. Russia's aware of that. They know that Trump admires Putin and Russia seeks to take advantage of that. That's the U.S. intelligence view of this. I had one former very senior advisor to this president say in these terms that Putin is Trump's honey trap. Huh. Pretty remarkable thing to hear, you know, honey trap, you know, the kind of attractive woman used to turn a spy.
Yeah.
That's a disturbing thing. I mean, you struggle to find the adjective, but as an American, it's a disturbing thing to hear about your president. And that, listen, I did ask the folks I interviewed, I said, do you think Putin's got the goods on Trump? You know, I asked him that, and, you know, whatever folks' private suspicions may be, no one that I spoke to had evidence of that. Mm-hmm. So the best explanation they came down on is that he admires the guy and just thinks he can get along with him.
But what does that mean in this context? Putin is Trump's honey trap. Honey trap is an espionage term for, you know, yeah, woman or sex to get someone to divulge secrets or turn. What does that mean in this context? Because that sounds pretty damning to me.
Well, there's no sex to my...
Okay.
It means that through the charm of personality and relationship and quid pro quo, mm-hmm, that Putin charms the U.S. president into seeing the world his way.
Okay. Okay.
You know, and therefore, you know, that's a big win for Russia. That's no small thing. Therefore, the president, for instance, can say U.S. troops in Europe are not helping keep the peace and defend Europe against Russian aggression. They're actually worsening the situation. Mm-hmm. That's a Russian position. We just withdrew a bunch of troops from Europe, you know? You know, there are, of course, the other instances where he straight up repeats Russian propaganda. I mean, the Helsinki moment, you know, was Russia really behind election interference? So that has consequences. There are other instances of how Putin holds sway over Trump in this sense. And that is that a lot of Trump's own advisors believe that Putin is the source of Trump's view of several things, that Trump's hostility to European leaders, our allies, is partly informed by Putin's view of those leaders, Merkel included, that Trump's understanding of the origins of World War II are influenced by Putin as well. You know, this idea that Russia was always a good actor on our side. I mean, remember the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact? I mean, they split up Poland, right? But that's forgotten. Of course, something that in Russian revisionism is forgotten as well. But you'll see President Trump kind of mimic that view of World War II. Mm-hmm. And it's a suspicion of people who work for the president that he gets that's influenced by the Russian president himself.
Your chapter on Russia is titled Strongman Good. Your title on China is Strongman Bad. Confronting China has been one of the most prominent features, probably the most prominent feature of Trump's foreign policy. In Trump's worldview, it seems like everything is just a zero-sum game with a winner and a loser. It doesn't seem to me that there will be a winner in the situation with China. Everyone loses. It's just a matter of who loses more. Is there a silver lining or an upside to Trump's China policy, or is it just mutually assured destruction?
Well, let's see. From my personal perspective, I spent a lot of time in China. It's where I spent most of my time studying, reporting, even worked in government there for a bit. And going in, and this is the way I start the chapter, is that, you know, China deserves to be stood up to, right, on so many issues. I mean, one just being the outright theft of U.S. intellectual property, cheating on international trade agreements, et cetera, that, you know, that Republican and Democratic administrations kind of missed it on China. They just sort of imagined to themselves that over time China would kind of reform itself. And that was, you know, belied by the facts for years. So standing up to that, you know, from a U.S. perspective is a good thing. You know, it's probably a necessary thing. The question is then, what do you do? The trouble with where we are now, particularly in election year, is that it appears that Trump has decided to make China the ogre of 2020, and they're like throwing everything at it right now. Listen, some of it deserved, right? I mean, China's behavior in Hong Kong needs to be called out, and there need to be penalties for it. The question is, what is the end game? Mm-hmm. Which is a question I asked on a whole host of these national security issues for Trump, and it's difficult to identify, even for his closest advisors. The president hasn't articulated it with China or with other countries, frankly. And if the president hasn't, We know his advisors haven't, because we know that the way national security works in this administration is it follows the president, right? You know, the policy kind of follows his decision making. So the worry is that, yes, good to stand up on this stuff, but how do you get to a place where you're getting what you want, as opposed to kind of a rapidly escalating standoff? I mean, Iran is another example that follows that pattern, right? The president came in, again, a campaign promise, I'm going to get out of the Iran nuclear deal. Okay, you don't think it's good enough. It's not broad enough. What have you replaced it with 4 years later? 4 years later, Iran is closer, not farther, from a nuclear weapon. You know, they busted through the limits on enriched uranium, heavy water, you know, a couple different paths to get to a bomb. And you've undermined your credibility as a country to make the next deal, not just with Iran, but North Korea. Why would North Korea believe, you know, let's say you sign a deal, limit your nuclear production and allow in inspectors. Wait a second, you guys just did that for Iran, then you walked out of it. So like with each one, you know, the first step can be justified. The trouble is, where does that take you, mm-hmm. other than kind of confrontation for confrontation's sake?
In the epilogue to your book, you say that the pandemic has perfectly crystallized Donald Trump's approach to the world and to the office of the presidency. How so?
It's because we've seen in this, and I articulated some in that chapter, facets of Trump's approach come across with ultimate clarity in his response to the pandemic. You know, minimize the severity of the crisis. We're still there, right, with this president, even 6 months in, and with the death toll rising and positivity rates up. Personalize it, right? It's about me. You know, what about my election? You know, how could this have happened to me? How can I, you know, respond to this in such a way that it helps my election results, as opposed to actually control the virus? I mean, heck, today he's talking about having a vaccine by November 3rd. Imagine that, you know. Also demonize the experts, you know, another aspect of his approach to so many things. I know better than them. I know better than Dr. Fauci on hydroxychloroquine or, you know, the severity of the outbreak, which is a pattern we've seen. I know better than the CIA on Russia, right? I know better than, you know, all of our allies on the Iran nuclear deal. So you've seen each of those character aspects, or just really, you know, facets of the Trump approach to the world coming across with the pandemic, and in a way that Americans can't ignore, right? Because if they think that Ukraine is a distant issue that doesn't really affect their lives, I disagree with that, by the way, because it goes to sort of sanctity of borders, security of Europe, etc. But you can understand why someone here would be like, that's a million miles away. Pandemic is on our doorstep. So this whole approach to what is a domestic problem, but a global one too, by the nature of a pandemic, it's now come to America's doorstep. So the madman theory with the pandemic is something that's, you know, we all have a very personal, direct experience of.
Well, when we take in the past 4 years in totality, has Trump's madman theory in toward national security and foreign policy been a success, a failure, or is it somewhere in between? Wait and see what?
By the pure measure of before and after, which I try to do in the final chapter of the book, it's a failure almost without exception, just in that, okay, let's go through. North Korea has more, not fewer, nuclear weapons. Iran is closer, not further, from a nuclear weapon. And by the way, is more active in terms of military aggression in the region than they were for 4 years ago. Russia is more, not less, aggressive on a whole host of fronts, including election interference, by the way, right? All the briefings now are that Russia is emboldened to interfere more in 2020 than in 2016, but other areas as well. China, China to some degree remains to be seen. I mean, certainly the relationship is no better. You can claim, and I think rightfully so, victories for finally setting a red line under Chinese abuses that you won't stand for anymore. What's still an open question is, do you get to a better place? So when you run through the biggest national security threats, you know, many of them we are backwards. Some is still an open question. Listen, credit where credit is due, and I talk about this, he killed Baghdadi, okay? It's not Bin Laden, right? But leader of ISIS.
Yeah,
and ISIS,
that's a big deal.
Though it was being curtailed at the end of the Obama administration, Trump unleashed the military a little bit more, gave them more leeway, and accelerated the demise of ISIS. That's a victory. Now, the question is, by pulling out of Syria, do you enable it to regenerate it as it did when Obama pulled out of Iraq? Open question there. I make a real effort here to be as fair as possible, to look where there is progress and elsewhere. But as a view of the world, really hard to call it a success, except in a couple areas, and in a lot of places, very clearly a failure. Mm-hmm.
And in the interest of fairness, it should be noted that in all of your interviews with current and former administration officials, no one believed that Trump is an actual madman or senile or in some way lacking his senses. So.
Exactly. And I made that clear, too. That's in the title. And that's why I make a real effort to begin right with Nixon. So folks know where this is coming from.
Yeah. Well, again, the book is called The Madman Theory: Trump Takes on the World. Jim Sciutto, thanks so much for talking with me.
Ben, I really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks so much for reading the book so closely.
Thanks again to Jim Sciutto for coming on the show. His book, The Madman Theory: Trump Takes on the World, comes out tomorrow, August 11th, but you can pre-order it today on Amazon, Audible, or wherever you like to listen. Jim anchors CNN Newsroom every weekday from 9 to 11 a.m. Eastern, and you can follow him on Twitter at Jim Sciutto. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit KickAssNews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.